As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg. Pim, why don't you bring in our esteemed guest, Stephen Whiting, with us with Citigroup, and that is a good thing.
Yes, it is. And Stephen Whiting is Citibank's private bank global chief investment strategist. Stephen Whiting, thanks very much for being with us. Your note talks about global trade wars. You say quick deals versus just the beginning. What do you mean by that?
Well, if you think about where we were with Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin coming back saying the trade war is on hold, we have the framework for an agreement with China. That's a very different situation than where we find ourselves today, where we actually have tariffs being collected and expanding. We were apparently fairly close to having deals wrapped up with NAFTA reforms, but all that has been pushed now further out. And we certainly have the prospect, at least the threatened prospect, of expanding the tariff war to the auto sector, which with complicated products and complicated supply chains, you know, would greatly expand the economic impact of this. So we have to consider really different environments. You know, you think about how long it took for the U.S. To cut corporate taxes, and this was all over a year-long drama, and it would greatly expand the impact in a negative way if this does drag out and escalate. It's really an unsustainable place for this to get
Stephen,
ever larger.
You are the expert at linking profit and corporate work into economics. It's chapter 24 of any volume one in economics. Nobody read it except Steve Whiting. How do trade tariffs actually filter in to the income statement of a given American multinational?
So this is much more important than I think economists generally are thinking about.
I agree.
If you scale the impact of, let's say, $20 billion in collected tariffs against GDP in the United States, you get a tenth of a percentage point, right? But if you take $20 billion out of, you know, large company profits, that number is going to be 20 times the size. So if you think about just lost business, now again, that can be gained business for someone else, and markets are not discriminating very well to say that someone else will get that business. But when it's lost sales, it's going to be a much bigger drop in profits because profits are marginal. You know, the scale is much, much smaller relative to sales. So that's why I think you can see very fundamentally equity markets swing much more than you will see any GDP estimate change on the direct impact of the tariffs collected. So I think a lot of economists have said, well, this is all just a sentiment issue, but it actually is a profit issue.
Well, Stephen Whiting, profits on the S&P 500 companies are supposed to rise, what, about 20% for the second quarter. Revenue is estimated to grow nearly 9% in the same quarter. Do you still have those numbers in your outlook?
I think we'll do even more than that. You know, and that's the hard part of this year, is that we set up for a powerful, strong, probably 20% earnings gain for the full year. You know, profits are not going to quickly stop growing here because of this issue. But the threat is building further out if the trade war escalates. I think it's a very serious issue. But the other side of this is that the quick deal scenario, the scenario where we were a couple months ago with these potential deals coming through, would have very little negative impact. And that's why markets are sort of really binary here on this particular issue. And it's not the only issue. There's, of course, the Fed. We could go on with numerous issues. But earnings are going to be powerful and strong, and not just in the United States this year.
Stephen Whiting, so why is the S&P 500 only up 4.5% this year?
Well, it's two things. You know, especially for the U.S. stock market, we had 2 years in which there was anticipation of tax cuts. And if you think about what, let's say, a 22% number in the second quarter would mean for EPS, about one-third of that will be driven by declines in corporate effective tax rates. So there's been this buying ahead of it all, which certainly made this year more modest. We had a big 20% plus year last year already in anticipation. So in many respects, we are looking at 2019 EPS, right, and discounting, you know, movements looking forward. The other side of this is the Federal Reserve is tightening. It's requiring savings flows to finance the U.S. government that it was providing before, earlier, and that natural interest rate pressure, which I again think has already been felt, you know, in the early part of the year. I don't think that interest rates rise amid this trade war, but that is already knocked down. You can see the effect in January was not, you know, a negative effect from the trade war. It was interest rate pressure.
What are the partial differentials at the top line of the income statement? And take them over to the broader macro economy. Is this about less units being sold? Is it about price dampened because of a lower nominal GDP after the 7% joy we're living right now? Which matters, units or price?
Well, units are going to be really important for profits if, you know, for example, you have to price things less efficiently. If you have a lack of choice, for example, and consumers have shortages. Now, again, I'm talking about this in the way that if a trade war accelerates, you get these sorts of issues. But whether consumers push back and you have to absorb tariffs and profit margins is important, or the worst thing is that you actually have disruptions to supply chains, which would be, you know, a much more significant worsening than you see so far. But the disruptions to the ordinary, the efficient functioning across borders is a potential issue. And that can change over time. And you can find and you see in some regions of the world, domestic production comes back, but there's a transition cost to that and time, and there are disruptions, and the market has to consider that. I don't think that this is the end of the world by any means. And again, the impact could be very small. We could be quite positive, focusing right back on those earnings results if there are resolutions to trade issues. And the optimistic view of this was, for example, that the U.S. was going to drive declines in trade barriers and improved U.S. exports. But that optimistic view, I think it's a little bit tougher here when we see retaliation accelerate.
Thank you very much. Stephen Whiting, he is Global Chief Strategist at Citi Private Bank, talking about the corporate earnings environment.
A quick start to the NATO meetings. It is perfect. It is perfect to speak with Robin Niblett. And I urge you folks to go to the Chatham House website and see a terrific, concise interview with Dr. Niblett. Trump is heading to Europe for an ideological battle. Did you think it would start this quickly?
No, to be frank, I didn't. To see the way he handled the breakfast this morning with the NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, it was like one of those. He's used to sitting at a cabinet table and have everyone praise him over their croissant or breakfast or whatever. But it was more Putin-esque. You know, Putin takes ministers to task, and he really went for them. And of course, he went for them about Germany, not about NATO as a whole. So he put the NATO Secretary General in an impossible position.
Robin Niblett, I'm wondering if you can describe, why do you believe that European leaders are surprised by the behavior and the comments of President Donald Trump? Have they not been paying attention since he was elected?
No, I mean, I think they are used to him leading up with lots of fire and fury. They're used to him then recasting what happened with fire and fury, as he did after the G7 meeting, and they're used to some pretty tough language off camera, perhaps during the meetings themselves, but to actually sort of publicize the dirty linen this way in front of the world press right at the kickoff, I think they're just having to learn to adjust even more quickly, and very difficult to do if you're 27, 28 countries.
Well, if you're the head of one of those 27 countries, why would you not get ahead of the situation by actually putting forth a plan that would address some of the issues that the president has raised?
Well, I think this is the irony here, is that they have. The European members of NATO have spent the last 2 to 3 years, since the Warsaw summit, actually, even before President Trump came to power, moving slowly, I would say, too slowly in my opinion, but moving towards the 2% of GDP spending on defense target. They've gone from 3 countries spending it to 8. Every country across the board has raised defense spending. On average, it's been a 6% increase from the year before. They've committed training troops to Iraq. They've committed troops to go out to Afghanistan. They've agreed 2 new military commands. I mean, they're trying to jump to the Trump tune and get ahead of the curve, so that what they were hoping is that President Trump would arrive and say, look at all this stuff these NATO countries are doing. I'm the driver. I made this happen. But guess what? He comes around and catches them on the blind side.
Your study of history and the body of people's scholarship that you have at Chatham House, there's a massive school of thought which will be wait out this president. Discuss that from a British or a continental standpoint. Do they wait out Trump, or do they adapt to Trump, or do they manage this as a permanence of the president of the United States?
It's a very interesting question, Tom. I think, and look, as the director of Chatham House, coming to our 100th anniversary in 2 years' time in 1920, most of the big think tanks, Council on Foreign Relations, Brookings, Carnegie, ourselves, founded in the 1920s, after the collapse, well, because there were no big institutions to really help manage the world, all of these think tanks, such as ours, were involved in creating the Bretton Woods institutions in the 40s and the 50s. Mm-hmm. And yes, you're right. The instinct is to say we should wait him out and sanity will return to an understanding that multilateralism, you know, is the glue that helps economic prosperity rise. But right now, I think the worry is, no, maybe we're going back to something that is more like the 1900s or the 1930s, where the institutions are going to collapse, and we better get ready for a world in which America will not be by Europe's side.
And Pim, this is extraordinary.
Well, I got to say, I was listening to some old recordings of former Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, and Chief of Staff George C. Marshall talking about the Marshall Plan, and back in the time of President Harry Truman, and even then, it really took George Marshall a whirlwind trip around the United States in order
to sell it.
Exactly.
Well, this is true. And Ben Steele at CFR did a great one volume on this recently. The Marshall Plan, is that from another lifetime?
It's from another lifetime in the sense that Europe was not just on its knees, it was devastated at the end of the Second World War. I mean, it might have been a relatively short war compared to the wars that we see today of Afghanistan, but it absolutely left Europe on its knees. And the communism would have come in and taken over the bulk of Western Europe, which would have been bad for the United States and bad for its economy. So there was a huge self-interest, as long as you could sell it to the American people to do it.
And I go back to Chancellor Merkel's emotional headline today in her speech, or comments rather, about living in East Germany under the Soviet influence. What will you listen for quickly? What will you listen for in the next 24 hours in Brussels?
I'm going to look to see whether the breakfast with Stoltenberg is just the beginning of a continuing berating and battle against the rest of Europe, or whether this is his opening point and he pivots to saying, you know what, they're listening to me. I think we're making good progress.
Okay. Robin Niblett, thank you so much again. I can't convey enough the briefing from Dr. Niblett. You are advantaged by going to Chatham House and looking for that. I've got that out on Twitter.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Rupert Murdoch's 21st Century Fox increased its bid for the part of Sky Broadcasting, that's the pay TV operation based in the UK. They increased their bid to $32 billion. That is 12% more than a bid from Comcast. And here to tell us about this particular bid and how it plays into the overall drama of the assets of 21st Century Fox is Brian Weiser. He is the senior analyst for Pivotal Research Group. He covers advertising, media, and the internet, and he joins me here in our 1130 studios. Brian, thank you very much for being with us. Before we get into this specific Sky bid, can you tell me what kind of company has Disney been for investors? Has it been a really successful investment if, let's say, you decided that Bob Iger was your champion and you were going to put your money in Disney? Has that been a really profitable investment?
That's a good question. I mean, it really just depends on when you started. I feel like the stock hasn't really done a lot, depending on the day.
But compared to other stocks, it hasn't. I was looking, for example, of the last 8 years.
Well, I mean, the concern for a long time really was, I mean, when was it? Mid-15, I think, was, you know, the market was really spooked about the permanent status of ESPN as this massive growth driver. And I think that all of a sudden, when they had to bring down a long-term guidance expectation, and, you know, I think that's when everyone brought their expectations towards reality. In subsequent periods, I think there was some relative optimism. And in fact, they said a good strategy. The problem is it's an expensive one. And with all that's going on between with Fox and the bid for Sky and Comcast out there raising the prices for everyone involved, the problem is the amount of time it'll take to make this worthwhile is a very long time. And the only potentially good news from this, you know, higher bid for Sky, if this plays out, is that Comcast might then bid higher, and then Disney at least would get a better price on the 39% that it will end up owning, which will help offset the amount they're overpaying for the rest of Fox. So it's, unfortunately, it's a great strategy. It's great if you've got a 10 and 20 year time horizon. They're probably well positioned relative to alternatives, but the problem is it's just a very expensive stock.
Brian, your joy, your expertise, the reason we drag you on as often as we can, is you link all this into what we hate, which is advertising. All of this transaction, the billions and billions of dollars, is predicated on the game continuing. Who is most in doubt of their future advertising revenue? Fox, Comcast, or Disney?
You know, I think Fox is arguably the one most in doubt of their ability to compete. I mean, one of the factors that spooked Rupert Murdoch from reporting subsequent to the event was when, you know, in India, they're out there bidding for rights to cricket for their Indian business. And Facebook was out there with $600 million bid for this content that, you know, in a market where there's about $1 billion of annual revenue, of advertising revenue. And, you know, that I think was a thing that made them, now Fox and their Indian satellite TV business ended up winning the rights to cricket. But I think it spooked them because of the resources involved and for businesses that are entirely ad dependent. Ironically, and a little reported, it was last week, Facebook agreed to the English Premier League soccer rights for, let's be clear, Cambodia, Laos, and Thailand, those hot advertising markets, for $200 million, I believe, pounds for 3 years in markets where, again, there's about a total of $1 billion of annual digital advertising spending in total. And so you have Facebook, again, showing they'll open up their wallets to pay for content. Amazon will do the same. And so I think that to the extent that Amazon is not ad dependent, of course, but I think that a belief that this growth can fuel ongoing growth is behind or key to Facebook and Google and Amazon, you know, spending for content, increasing competition.
I just in the time that we've got left with you, Pim, I don't know where you want to go with this. We can go so many ways with Brian, but you've been such an acute analyst of Twitter. Am I right that you still have a cell on Twitter?
I do, and the irony is—
Aren't they doing better?
The irony is I consider myself to be relatively positive about them. The problem is the stock has run away with itself. Investors have traded it up because everyone's trading it up. They get optimistic about user growth, and they think that that matters. And the problem is it doesn't. They're a stable business, which is fine. And, you know, this announcement or this Washington Post piece from Friday where they announced 70 million accounts being, canceled. First of all, this was misunderstood widely because an account that gets created in the same day and then gets eliminated in the same day is never included in their monthly active users, right? But investors kind of ran the other way thinking, oh, this is going to be terrible, negative, et cetera. But the user growth expectations that fueled the stock's rise recently were overdone and overstated. But the business is stable, at least.
Brian Weiser, I got to ask you just as a comparison here, because we talked about advertising, right? So what I did was I looked at the performance over the last 8 years, so back to 2010, of Disney, of Comcast, and of Netflix, because Netflix, of course, a subscription business, whether it was selling, you know, renting you CDs or whether it's streaming, right? Okay, so Disney over that period, a 250% increase in the stock price over the last 8 years. Comcast, 325%. Okay, so both of those look pretty good. Okay, but that's over 8 years. Oh, and then when you look at Netflix, yeah, you're smiling, and so are those investors in Netflix. Netflix has returned 2,375% over that same period. So this idea of advertising, can we just put a, you know, a stake through the heart of advertising and say, you know, if the content is there and people want it, they'll pay for it. And that's not a bad model.
Oh, absolutely agree with that. I mean, although if you want to run that chart, then run Facebook as well. And I think
correct,
see, which is entirely advertising dependent, and Google.
I'm not saying they can't coexist. I'm just saying that there isn't just one model.
Oh, absolutely. And by the way, I actually think advertising is not a very good business. I just happen to cover it.
Well, clearly you don't have many buys, and you don't have many. You only got as long as I see.
Nielsen's a buy, and I just Nielsen's launched on Criteo. Yeah, which is I think undervalued. Investors have overreacted to the downside there.
Brian, if the view from London's different from the wonderful view that Pim sees in Midtown, is Madison Avenue still there?
Yeah, I think it's a block away. Madison Avenue is resilient. I think marketing, broadly defined, remains a really important function. It is not, however, a marketer's job to keep ad-supported media owners in business. Sorry. You're lucky. You guys, and Bloomberg is a great example. You're not dependent on advertising, right? That's kind of the whole point, that there are other revenue streams. There are other ways to make a business grow. But when it comes to solely having a business depend on advertising, over time, that becomes a less interesting business.
Well, Brian, thank you so much. Brian Weiser with a good update here on what we're going to see. And we've had different opinions. Our Matthew Bloxham looking for some form of actions from the Roberts family. I guess I can state sooner than later, Pim. I guess we'll have to see on that.
I want to shift attention because history is one thing, but the stock market looks to the future in order to make money. And joining us now is investment strategist for Edward Jones, Kate Warren. She joins us here in our 1130 studios. Kate, thanks very much for being with us. Much appreciated. I want to get right to the idea of specific companies that you think are going to do well despite all of the chaos and all of the headlines that Tom was just describing. One of them has to do with technology, and that is Microsoft. Why do you think Microsoft is the kind of company that people ought to own?
Because we're seeing businesses and consumers shift things towards the cloud. And Microsoft is a very competitive company in that area. They've been basically transforming the company from what we've all been familiar with in terms of the Windows operating systems and PCs towards cloud computing. And it's that success that we think continues to drive the stock price higher. but also is something that is really not going to be affected very much by the pace of economic growth or by trade worries. And so that's why we think it's a very attractive company to put into your portfolio today. It's got a dividend yield of almost 2%. We think dividends are going to continue to grow, but it's that really good positioning and the fact that they almost are able to create their own growth by taking advantage of the trend in cloud computing that we think really positions it well.
Now, why Microsoft, let's say, over Amazon? Because, of course, Amazon Web Services, a big contributor of profits. They're in the same business,
exactly.
Cloud computing.
Yes. We also have a buy rating on Amazon. So
okay.
We're not saying, you know,
one or the other, right?
One or the other. We have buy ratings on both. And I think that's what's really important, which is Microsoft is something I'm talking about because I think it's well positioned today, but it's not Microsoft versus every other company. And I think even more important is investors need to be looking at their own portfolios and saying, what do I need to add? How do I keep a very well diversified equity portfolio with not just U.S. large cap stocks like Microsoft or Amazon, but also smaller companies that might be able to benefit more from faster growth? So make sure you're building the right portfolio for your situation and that if you're already overweight in technology, you're not adding Microsoft to that because staying diversified across a variety of sectors is really what's important right now.
So let's talk about another sector. I want you to talk about Novartis.
Yes.
Why?
Again, because it's a company that's making a transition. In this case, they've done a strategic review of their businesses, and they're basically focused much more on their pharmaceutical development business, where they've got cell therapies, gene therapies, basically things where they're new innovative drugs, and we think that'll drive growth over time. They've also decided to spin off their Alcon business. We're all familiar with their eye products into a separate company. Frequently when companies do that, it's a catalyst for the stock to do better. And that should happen sometime in 2019. We're looking at Novartis as basically well-diversified. It's got a generic drug business that's the second largest. So it seems well-positioned in this world where there's a lot of uncertainty about pricing of prescription drugs.
We just heard, for example, the president battling against Pfizer. And Pfizer pulling back on those drug increases.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons to always be looking at the drug pipeline and thinking about what are the new drugs coming out? Because I think in many cases, the pricing issue is a little less when it's something new, innovative, and where it's really important in terms of healthcare over time.
Thank you very much for spending time with us. Kate Warren, investment strategist for Edward Jones, speaking about Novartis and Microsoft.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keene. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.